Where is your mind while you're at work? Do you ever feel like you're just getting by or barely managing to hold on and hold it together? I'm Ilana Afrika Bredenkamp. Welcome to Mind at Work. In this series, we explore the mental hurdles we face in the workplace and how understanding our minds can lead to real, lasting solutions. I'm very excited to have today's discussion because when we made and intended to make this podcast, everyone said, oh, you know, but the schedules are too busy. We don't have enough this. We don't have resources. We don't. And I guaranteed my team. I said to them, we have enough people in South Africa who want to help. So I am so happy. Dr. Matsebula, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's an absolute
pleasure. Laurie Molnar, thank you so much for being here today. Thank we really you. Appreciate you. Dr. Matsebula is a psychiatrist. Laurie Molnar is a life coach. And both of them change people's lives in some formal way. Doctor, I want to start with you. Do you know that when I mentioned to people a psychiatrist is joining me on the show, the one lady cancelled. Okay, she went, oh, well, she didn't come back. The other person said, oh, no, don't put me next to the psychiatrist because I wouldn't know what to say because they thought it was a debate. And I'm going, but why the stigma? So there was not just a stigma against psychiatry, but even with a guest, unbeknownst that it's you, but because they knew a psychiatrist is coming, it was like it evoked a certain kind of fear.
Unfortunately, stigma still is a bit of a challenge.
What are we scared of?
So there's the fear that, weirdly enough, the psychiatrist is going to see through them, as it were. Or the psychiatrist is going to tell them their challenges just by looking at them, as silly as that sounds. But I think it's got to do a lot with this fear or not understanding of the unknown, which is what, unfortunately, mental health is for a lot of people. A lot of people equate mental health to mental illness, to having an ambulance coming to pick you up or police coming to pick you up, whereas it's the exact opposite. When we talk about mental health, we're talking about a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being. And it is this state of well-being that allows a person to achieve many things in their life, to be able to withstand life stressors, to work productively, to chase, set goals, realize their ability. So it's an absolutely multifaceted thing. And I'm really glad that we're having this discussion because we need to help people understand that we need to help them protect mental health, maintain mental health, and to reduce the risks of getting mental illness. And hopefully to destigmatize mental illness as well.
I enjoy the fact that because there have been other experts that I spoke to, and they differentiate and create that space between mental health and mental illness. You can go there. I mean, what is the difference between mental health and mental illness?
So thank you for that. So mental health, as I've mentioned, you are able to live the best quality of life that you can. If you are in school, it'll allow you to achieve all of the academic goals that you need to. And when we're speaking about school, we're speaking about primary school, high school, all the way through to tertiary. We are speaking about a person that is at work. That person is able to set their goals, like I mentioned. They're able to problem solve. They're able to prioritize. They're able to do all of the things that are required of them in the workplace. They are also able to take care of their families. They're able to attend to important aspects of their being. That is mental health in a nutshell. When we speak about mental illness, there is a growing inability to attend to all of these things that I've spoken about. Or there is the emergence of unhealthy coping behaviors. And for some people, unfortunately, they will be able to feel that there's something that's not quite right with them. And that's where we see unhealthy coping mechanisms. That's where the glass of wine becomes two glasses of wine, becomes a whole bottle of wine. So mental illness is the absence of mental health. And we can promote mental health. We can treat mental illness. We can prevent mental illness in some cases. And we'll talk about that as we continue.
What can psychiatry do for me in the workplace? You know, when you tell me that I have the ability to thrive, immediately I want to chase the dream.
Yeah, quite right, quite right. The adage prevention is better than cure applies here. I like to give practical examples to people. I do know that sometimes when we speak about certain concepts relating to mental health and mental illness, it can be vague, it can be abstract. I like to talk about, let's say, a long distance runner, for argument's sake. You have a long distance runner, the person is training, they, you know, enroll in the race, and they start to run. A few kilometers down the road, they feel that there's something happening in their thigh muscle. Well, you can pick any muscle there. And instead of attending to it, they try to muscle through that discomfort. And then the discomfort becomes pain. And then after the pain, they trip, they fall, and then there's an injury. And what happens there is now you need professionals who will help them get up, maybe take them to hospital, maybe do an x-ray, maybe put on a bandage, maybe give them painkillers, and then they get discharged. They may need physiotherapy, and all of this time, the race is continuing. The other runners are now far
ahead. They are winning now.
They're winning. They're winning. Far right. And so the act of doing all of these interventions, not only is it expensive, it's also time consuming. It also removes the runner from the race. And that is what happens when a person becomes unwell and is unable to attend to all of the things that they need to attend to. So that's the cure part. But when we speak about prevention, when the runner is training or when they begin to run, they might feel that, hang on, there's a bit of a niggle here. Maybe let me slow down a bit. And in that slowing down or going to one of these stations and they pour water or they rub something on their thigh muscles, they're still able to continue on that actual race itself. Yes, they might be a bit behind, but they're able to continue with the race. Less time, less effort, less cost. So to answer your question, prevention is better than cure. There are a lot of things that we as psychiatrists advise people to do to take care of their mental health. By extension, taking care of your brain. And it's not big things. These are not big concepts. It's really small things. Eating as regularly as you can. Many people have this really unhealthy habit of wake up in the morning, get the kids ready, jump in the car, go to work. When you get to work, I'll have a cup of coffee and then I'll do what I have to do. We need to feed the brain. Feed the brain. Feed it. And I'm repeating the word feed on purpose because the brain is an energy intensive organ. It needs energy. And the only way it's going to get energy is through oral intake or through food. So please, people, eat. At work, it's absolutely essential that you try to come up with some way of scheduling your day. And that is so important. If you don't have a schedule, you are most likely to feel frazzled. I know it's not a scientific term, but I'll use it. You are more reactive to stress. So you're feeling frazzled. Someone comes and throws a couple of papers on your desk. Please help me with this. Instead of saying, I'm a bit busy at the moment, I can't do this for you now, the reaction is going to be one of anger, irritability. Why don't you do it yourself kind of thing? The other thing that we ask people to do is to try take breaks. As reasonably as possibly as you can, please, please, please take breaks. And we're not talking about disappearing from your workstation for hours and hours and end. 10 minutes every 2 hours, more than enough. Lunchtime, eat if possible, step away from your work desk, please. In the afternoons, in the evenings, when you're knocking off, just make sure that you sort everything out. I tell my clients, when you close that laptop, think of your mind closing files as well, so that when you walk out of that building, you've left work stuff behind. You're not going to be thinking about work stuff when you go home. If you should have a car and you're driving home, if you should be in public transport, listen to things that make you happy. It could be music. It could be a podcast like this one. And it is known, it is scientifically proven that listening to things that bring you pleasure are actually going to reduce the amount of stress hormones in your body. So we're talking about things like adrenaline and cortisol. Those are going to go down. When you get home, again, please eat. if you can, some form of physical activity. If you can go to the gym, fine. Mm-hmm. If you can't go to the gym, even the act of doing chores around the house, playing with your children if you have children, that counts as physical activity. And then when it is time perhaps to go to bed, please, please, please have regular sleep times, have healthy sleep hygiene, and we can talk about that. But the most important thing for me would be to take a couple of minutes to reflect on how the day went. You don't need to reflect on anything, just one or two things. One thing which went really well and one thing that didn't go so well. When you look at the thing that didn't go well, that will help you because you'll reflect and you'll see maybe there's something I can do differently the next time the stressor comes around. When you look at things that went well, it's going to help in terms of how you think about yourself, what you feel about yourself. It's very easy for a human being to fall into thinking negatively or in an unhealthy way about themselves. If you can do these things that I've spoken about, you will be taking care of your brain. And if you take care of your brain, you'll be able to attend to whatever you need to attend to at home, in the community, and in the workplace.
We also have Laurie Milner in our studio, beyondthedress.co.za. Laurie, you're a life coach, and we're going to be speaking to you on the series more than once. It's so exciting to hear that there's so many people that want to help us, you know, that want to help our minds at work. When we think of intervention, right, and the things that doctor has mentioned, this beautiful routine of trying to help us, what do you think, what role does psychology, psychiatry, coaching, what role do we as people that are change makers play in the workplace?
So I think for me, it's about how do we take the knowledge and the wisdom that we've just heard from you. And I think for me, the role of the coach is to say how, because there's a huge gap between knowing. So I know all of the stuff that you've just said. How do I do it? And I think that's because if, you know, we know it's not knowledge is enough on its own. It's about the implementation of it. And I think that's where, that's what I see my role is. And I often say, you know, I'm not a coach. I'm actually a permission agent. I'm a permission device. It's, I know what I should be doing. Okay, this is how you do it. And practically for, you know, everybody's individual. So the one way someone's going to implement it is different to someone else. How do I make it real in your world?
When we started this podcast, I thought to myself, you know what? When you're at work, you need to be at work. Perhaps the workplace is not a place to be vulnerable and to tell people about your feelings and to tell people about your pulls and to bother people, you know? Why do we have that feeling? I'll tell you what happened. So the other day I made a gig and my colleague, it happened to be really early, my colleague's having a cup of coffee and then he had his cocktail of medicines. So now there's a blue pill, a white pill, a yellow pill. And I looked at it and I thought, look at him. He's not hiding it. It was lying on his desk and he's about to take his medication. He's just had breakfast. And it's the first time, other than a partner or my mom that takes medication, that I saw that someone is openly taking their medicine, you know, their routine. Do we leave our pills at home? Is there space for psychiatry in the workplace where we've got a diagnosis and now do we need to tell everyone?
It's a really good question. There is no simple answer to that question, unfortunately. And I think that speaks to how society still thinks about mental illness. The short answer to your question would be, what is that environment or the work culture like? Is it one that is accepting of people's idiosyncrasies and differences? Is it one that has got an unhealthy culture? Is it one that has a cookie cutter approach? I had this difficulty, therefore you must, you know, kind of thing. And that is what I think is going to influence disclosing. In terms of medication, we always, as psychiatrists and indeed in clinicians in general, tell people, please make sure you take your medications and take your medications every day if it's those. If you need to maybe move things around during the day so that you are able to take your medication, then please do that. At the end of the day, as important as the workplace is for an individual, the individual's health is infinitely much more important.
Wow.
Because the health and the individual, by extension, is irreplaceable. The workplace can be replaced. And so, please, people must take their medications. In terms of disclosing, people don't have to disclose what the actual diagnosis is. They don't need to tell the workplace about the nitty-gritties of the diagnosis. What the workplace is concerned with is the functional ability of the individual.
Right.
And that is where the disclosing then can come in. In some cases, when we do certain documents like a long-ish sick leave or filling in claim forms for an insurer, then yes, then we do need to disclose.
Right.
Should the person disclose, the person that receives this information needs to treat it with respect.
Mm-hmm.
They need to treat it with the confidentiality that it deserves. In other words, if I come to you and I say, I am being treated for depression, the doctor's giving me this medication, we don't expect you to then go tell people at the water fountain or in the cafeteria that Dr. Matsebula is taking medication for depression. That's why XYZ. That's not done. It's an absolute no-no. So if the environment or the culture at work is one that is welcoming, that is one that is accepting of individuals, then yes, people can disclose. And I think we can even expand that to greater society as well. And that's what makes me so excited about this platform. The more we're able to talk about these things, the easier it will be for society to A, understand these things, and B, to accept these things should they come into being.
Coach, but my work is my life. You know, I have been in service for 30 years and I don't know anything else. Some of my listeners they are retiring in the first job that they started many years ago, and I am defined by what I do, but what I do for a living. If my job is not me, who am I? You know, my family, my job family, you know, I want to just tell them everything. I want to tell them the pills I use. I want to tell them how I love my partner. I want to tell them that I won 15 rand in the lottery, you know. Why are we so attached? Why does it mean so much, this concept of work? Why are we so loyal and so committed? And is it the money?
So I think it's when it becomes almost even more than an identity, but a place that you're saying that I, you know, when you can say my work family, it goes a level further. And for me, I think it has to go further than money, because money's not going to be fulfilling long term. And I'm trying to make it a short answer to what you're saying. So there's a framework it's from human needs psychology. It was then popularized by Tony Robbins, called the six human needs. And what it speaks about is that we all have six basic needs that we need to meet. They're not values, they're not beliefs, but they're fundamental needs. And I'll go through them really quickly, but often what happens is that work is a place that meets these needs at such a high level. And that's why it becomes, and I'm using an addiction, not in a negative way, it's positive. It's something that we are driven for. And the six needs, the number one is certainty. You know, it's about safety. It's about comfort. It's about knowing. It's sometimes that predictability. The second need's about variety. And work does that every day for most of us. It's something different. It's not that we're coming to the same every single day. Even the people give us variety. The conversations we have give us variety. The third need is about significance, which is, am I seen? Do I matter? And for most of us, however we're showing up is because it's giving us that platform to be seen. And also, if I'm growing my team, wow, I feel significant. The fourth need is love and connection. So just, you said my work family, that's already connection in itself. So the first four are the needs of the personality. The last two are the needs of fulfillment. So number five is the need for growth, because all of us have that need. Am I expanding? Am I improving? Am I better than I was? And work is generally going to give us that opportunity to do it. And why do we want to grow? So to meet the sixth need, which is contribution. Am I part of something bigger than myself? And so often for most of us, work is that place that meets those needs at a high level. And sometimes when we don't have certainty at home or we don't have other things at home, guess what? Work does meet my needs and maybe I spend a little bit too much time there. So we could argue maybe we do spend too much time. We've got to start to say, is work becoming a distraction? But for me, that's why. But from a positive point of view, because it plays such a big role in our lives.
Are we ever going to normalize psychiatry? I mean, what are you doing as a doctor in order to help our workplace, other than Mind at Work and this conversation that we're having, to help our colleagues understand? I mean, I'm not saying let's normalize it and let's make it all about pill popping and coaching, you know, because we've got work to do. But somehow we need to understand that there's people in our businesses that needs our help. So my question is, when will people understand that all of us need to be helped differently? I mean, we have our wellness day and now, you know, the coach has come to speak and Ilana, I'm doing a wellness day tomorrow, you know, and Ilana's come to talk, you know, the celeb. Where's the psychiatrist?
Thank you. That is a very good question. And it is one that speaks to how, as specialists in particular and doctors in general, we need to move more into the health promotion space as opposed to just being in the curative space.
Mm-hmm.
Psychiatrists, yes, people will, you know, get referred to us by either psychologists that we work with or general practitioners. In some cases, the person themselves, you know, him or her or they might feel that there's something that is going on in their health or with their health rather, and they need some assistance. So there we come in. We are moving into, as I've mentioned, the mental health promotion space. So psychiatrists are now, you're being found in corporate spaces, for an example, in wellness days like you have spoken about. We do try to honor as many speaking engagements as we possibly can. The major hindrance, unfortunately, is there's less than 1,000 psychiatrists in the entire South Africa. I think it's about 600 odd of us. And so you find that we then get very, very busy and we aren't able to go and do these other much needed things as much as we would like to. But what is absolutely beautiful about this time and age that we find ourselves in, rather, is we now have got social media. A lot of psychiatrists are available on social media and they regularly post messages to that effect. We are going and doing interviews. So there's a lot. We're just unfortunately hindered by time and our numbers. You asked a really important question. You asked whether will we ever get to the point where we can speak about psychiatry and mental illnesses with the ease with which we speak about hypertension, for an example, or cholesterol. I think with time, I think with consistency in terms of speaking about mental health, mental illness, we should be able to get there. I think if we look at HIV, for an example, when HIV first became prominent in society, there was a lot of stigma. You know, people wouldn't talk about it. People would hide it. And we contrast that with where we are now, where we freely speak about HIV. We freely speak about the research that's going into it. And I think with time, psychiatry is going to get there as well. I think it's just a matter of time.
And Ilana, if I can make a point on that, there's space for everything. I've worked with clients who were seeing a psychiatrist and we both had a role to play. I've had clients that were seeing me, but also in therapy. And all these practices have a role to play and there's different elements. And, you know, if that's what that individual needs to be their best self, then it all fits together because then it's just looking for different tools to get them to that best version.
You just want attention. Leave your pills at home. Soek aandag. I grew up in Cape Town. So, you know, that's one of the things. Soek net aandag, man. You know, when there's looking for attention, when there's something up. You know, he's mal, he's crazy, you know. What role do we play? Doctor, what role do I play in the workplace when someone has disclosed to me, well, you know, I have a psychiatrist, or you walk into them like I did the other day when my colleague is sipping on a cocktail of medicine? I mean, What do I do? How can I help and be of use?
May I go back to those statements that you
yes,
made?
Yes, please.
And I think it's really important that we also put in the historical background. Mm. Like history tends to inform the present as well.
Sure.
Mental illness has been there for as long as human beings have walked the planet. I think that's the first point. And mental illness, more especially when it gets to moderate and severe degrees of severity, it presents as this person not meeting societal expectations. And that was initially viewed as, is there something demonic about this person? Mm. Does this person need to be taken to the temple, to the sangoma, to the church? Mm. What else? What's going on with this individual? And unfortunately, those beliefs tend to stick. It tends to be a bit difficult to get rid of them.
To shake.
Yeah. And I think it is those beliefs that then lead us to have the stigma that we have today. You're looking for attention.
Mm.
Or you're weak. Or people now can't have bad days. It's absolute nonsense. Unfortunately, all of that is stigma. And stigma relates to negative stereotypes that we might have. It speaks to prejudice. It speaks to discrimination.
Mm.
So what can we do as individuals? So here's someone, the person has disclosed that they have a mental illness. Or like your colleague, the person is freely taking their medication openly and not hiding. First step, be aware of your own attitudes, your own behaviors. If you don't know a lot about mental health, then the information is readily available. Please go read up about it. The South African Depression and Anxiety Group has got an excellent website that you can, access. There are some hospital groups in the US that have got really, really excellent websites. So read. The other thing I think would be to learn to listen when the person is telling you about their experiences. Listen. Don't listen to respond, but listen to learn, listen to understand. And the most important one for me as a psychiatrist, listen with respect and treat this person with dignity. I think that's the absolute best way that we can support any individual for that matter. And I think there's nothing wrong with asking the person if you feel that the person is not feeling too well on that particular day, are you okay? Is there anything that I can do to help?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the person doesn't need anything, but they need a sympathetic ear, for argument's sake. So during lunch break, when you're sitting at the canteen, if there's a canteen, or you're sitting at your desk, the person will speak about how they're really struggling to accept that diagnosis, that they now have to take medication. It's just to be there, just to listen, and to be aware of any possible prejudices or stereotypes that a person has. We can expand this to the workplace now. And there it's really, really important that workplaces have a culture of acceptance, have a culture that does not exclude, and have a culture that is sympathetic. Yes, we are human beings. Yes, we do go to work and we are expected to put in whatever we put in so that there's a product or a service at the end of the day. But that human being is a multifaceted individual. And we can't just view a human being as just a brain and hands to put together whatever service or product. So workplaces as well need to be accepting. And I think if the workplace has got a human resources department, for an example, it's an absolute good idea for that HR department to put together some form of training for the staff, for the leadership, and everyone that works in that environment. And I think if we can do that, and do that consistently, should work nicely.
I really like the concept of education, and continually having to learn. And because people change, but it feels like our policy stays the same,
Mm.
It's almost like as humans, we're growing so fast.
Yeah.
But everything else is staying quite stagnant and the rest is like water, is moving.
Mm.
You're in a work situation. And immediately I'm thinking of the person that has disclosed that there's, you know, something going on. I'm seeing doctor, I'm taking medication, or, you know, I'm seeing a coach. There's some kind of intervention. But I didn't disclose it to have some kind of pity, you know. So I want to show up at work with dignity, with my jacket like I'm wearing today and my scarf, you know. And immediately I'm thinking of the persona that approaches you. And this is some of the letters that we got from our listeners. You know, the parent at work. Oh, shame, is you okay? Are you okay today? Treating you as if something is always wrong. What do you do in a situation where you've disclosed, you want to show up as the professional, but you're always confronted either with pity, not empathy, but sympathy, this parent role of, oh shame, how are you feeling today, you know? Someone did it with me the other day and I returned it and they saw how silly it actually is, you know, because in my case, I didn't need it. What to do, Laurie?
I think it's also largely about if you own something, it loses the power over you. So if you've disclosed it, no one, you know, there's no more white elephant in the room. But I think it's also largely about the way that you're showing up, because if you are showing up and you're in a good space, or you're showing up and you're getting your stuff done and you're delivering, then there's nothing really for someone, you know, to go, oh, you know, but you're delivering, but how are you? So I think it's largely the way that, how are you carrying yourself? How are you showing up? What's your attitude? How are you walking in? Because it's, and, you know, to your point, doctor, it's okay not to be okay. You're allowed to have an average day. Stuff, even if you are not diagnosed with something, you're allowed to have an average day. Life's going to happen. You're allowed to get frustrated with something. We get disappointed. We lost the client. We lost the pitch.
We lost the rugby. Okay, now we won
the rugby. No. But so I think it's also how, you know, if you cannot allow that in, if you can not allow someone else's energy to affect you, and if it really does start to become a problem, then I would say something and say, you know, I'm fine, you know. So, but I think even for the other person, if you do know, if I know that, you know, you mentioned your colleague, I think sometimes, and to your point, and I just want to reemphasize it, is sometimes just how are you, and make that person feel seen. Because a lot of the time, you know, you feel like you're going through things by yourself, you feel like you're alone, and just how are you doing? Make that person feel seen and hold space for them. But don't let that person bring you down, because, and also, and that's the thing, people don't really know how to respond. And sometimes words are never going to be, it makes it worse. And it's also just going on positive intent. They are reacting the way that maybe that's their way of showing empathy. It's their way of showing that they care. It's not landing in the way that you would like it received. But if we can see it with positive intent, but if it's carrying on and it's becoming an issue, then I would say something.
I want to do some quick fire with you two, because I've got your attention now, and you're very valuable to Mind at Work, both of you. Thank you for coming so far. Now that she's a coach, she thinks she can tell me.
Number one. Don't give advice unless someone asks for it. Not everybody wants advice. Mm-hmm. And so don't enforce it on someone. Ask them if they would like advice.
Psychiatrist gives you pills. They don't even know what they give it for. They just give you pills to make you feel better. I've stopped mine.
Psychiatrists are specialists. They are scientists. Everything that they do is backed up by decades and decades of research. And the research is ongoing. Psychiatrists do many, many things besides just giving people tablets. We do therapy. We do forensic psychiatry. We help people that are elderly in terms of geriatric psychiatry. We help people that are struggling with substances, alcohol, dacha, cocaine. We also help people that are struggling with certain habits. Gambling, watching porn for others. The field of psychiatry is an extremely broad field, and it is one that can be extremely helpful to society. The indicators are there, unfortunately, that the burden of mental illness is becoming significant and needs to be addressed. In South Africa, we have insurance companies that routinely release statistics. And those are showing that people that are booked off work because of mental illness, those numbers are now surpassing things like musculoskeletal conditions,
right,
car accidents, lower back pain. That's how significant it is. The World Health Organization is saying the same thing as well globally. Mental illness is now among the top 10 causes of disability worldwide, causing the globe or the world a conservative estimate of $1 trillion.
Wow.
So mental illness is there, and psychiatrists definitely can help to address it and to promote mental health.
Having a life coach can make you rich because they give you tools that just propels you forward into the workplace.
The magic of coaching is twofold. And the magic of coaching happens in the conversation, but what happens between conversations? So you can take the tools and you can implement them and you can create small shifts every week and build upon that. And then, yes, you can, if it's changing the way that you're showing up, if it's changing the way you do things, you can start to create, because also wealth is going to mean different things for different people. I know you said money, but for wealth, it could be freedom of time. It could be
I'm putting
financial.
My hand up.
It could be. So for me, it's having a coach is going to give you the roadmap and guide you, but the magic happens of what you're doing. You've got to put in the work. No one's going to do the sit-ups for you. So it's a partnership.
I don't want a diagnosis. Why would I want a diagnosis? Because then I need to be on pills forever.
At times, there's no need for a diagnosis. At times, a person can come to see us in what we call the prodrome phase of the illness. So all illnesses, or a majority of illnesses, tend to have what we call a prodrome. That's where the person begins to feel that I'm not okay, not firing on all cylinders, what's going on? And in many instances, that's where people are going to go to their family doctor or to their general practitioner. The diagnosis does not need to be there, but an intervention can be done. In many instances, and we see this unfortunately far too frequently, people have developed an unhealthy way of thinking. It's not necessarily a diagnosis that needs a tablet, but it is something that we can help people work on. I'll give you one example. For many people, if you pay them a compliment, they're going to brush it off. Ah, nothing. We call that, it's got a big word. I won't use it. I don't want to.
Please
I
use it.
No, I don't want.
Please
I don't want.
Use
so
the
it's,
word, doctor.
It's called a cognitive distortion. And it's also known as discounting the positive. And that is an unhealthy way of thinking. An unhealthy way of thinking doesn't necessarily mean there's a diagnosis. It doesn't necessarily mean that we need to give the person tablets. But unhealthy thinking can negatively impact a person's quality of life.
Right.
If you can't accept compliments, in many instances, you will also not be able to validate yourself. And for me, as a psychiatrist, and I know for many of my colleagues, quality of life is an absolutely essential thing.
In the workplace, Laurie, I mean, we see that there is really beautiful ways of how we can resolve many, many personal issues in order for us to thrive in a professional environment. As the role of the coach at work, where do you think you could really help people? Because, you know, mind at work, we've been talking a lot about how do we stand up with our minds and our mental health, and if there is an illness, what to do, you know? But if I'm seeking the intervention of a coach, where would it benefit me the most?
It's a great question, and it's not a one-size-fits-all. And I absolutely agree with Doctor's comment that it often starts with the way that you think. It's the way that you're thinking about yourself. It's the way that you're looking at situations. Where would it benefit you the most from a work perspective? For me, it's about where are you planning? So what does that day look like? How are you planning? Are you creating structure? Do you know how to say no? Do you know how to set boundaries? Do you know how to ask for help? Do you know how to block out time for yourself? Mm-hmm. Not only block it out, but actually go, okay, I've blocked out Friday 11 to 1 for me. And then that time comes and someone asks you for something and you go, oh, it's fine, I'll do it tonight. So it's helping them. What does their day look like? Are they living by design? How do we give them? It's even the confidence, because it's often a fear of disappointing. It's wanting to keep the harmony. It's wanting to keep the balance. It's not that someone is lazy. It's often procrastination is a huge habit that comes up a lot. How do we unpack that? People procrastinate for different reasons, but it can really be a source of pain for people. And it can drive away a lot of relationships because of that. It could be, I'm in sales, I've got to present, but I get too anxious. So how do we then shift? Because it's, again, it's moving from, often people feel like I've got to do this performance and be perfect. No, I'm having a conversation. How do I be a contribution? How do you get someone at ease in their own skin so that they can deliver in that specific role? It could be, I need help. I'm a leader. Maybe I'm a first-time leader. What does that look like? Mm-hmm. You know, last year I was their colleague. Now I'm their boss. How do I navigate that?
Beautiful. Yeah.
You know, it could be, I'm a very direct person. I like things done this way. Often things is, it comes to control. So how do you help someone then, especially moving in, and even if they're not new in a leadership role, it's that need to control. How do I delegate? Because it's not only freeing up space for myself to work on what I need to, what am I doing to grow that team? And it's a letting go. How do you help someone through that process? Because it's not, you know, you should do it, but it's not easy. So there's a lot of different aspects in the workplace that when you just touch on certain things every week, and then to Doctor's point, it's the energy part. How are you helping them to build themselves into their calendar, that there is a mindfulness practice, that there is paying attention to sleep, and helping them build in those tools so that you can have mental health prevention?
I want to try something. Normally, I would say, Doctor, give us some advice. You know, we want to go home with advice in the workplace. And this time, I want to say, what are some of the questions that I need to ask self in order to show up with the right mind at work? I mean, we're all in the this is God's work, okay? We're in the business of helping people. So if I want to show up in the right mind space at work, so mind at work, what kind of questions should I be asking self?
Can I respond?
Yes, please.
So some questions you could ask yourself, how can I be kind to myself today? Mm-hmm. What can I be grateful for today? How can I be a contribution today? How can I connect to my team today? You know, even how can I connect to my family? And sometimes even if you're going through change and it's something stressful, how can I enjoy this process? So it's always questions that are going to redirect our focus. And if we can just change that lens with a more empowering question, then for me, that's a better question, like a Google search. Better question, better answer. You know, and one that I always love and I always share with my clients, it's not how can I show up as my perfect self? How do I show up as my authentic self?
Doctor?
So I agree with Laurie. As a psychiatrist, I am obsessed with the brain. I am obsessed with the structure of the brain. I'm also obsessed with how the brain works. And there we are talking about how the person thinks. For many people, unfortunately, it might be a bit difficult to start to do that work. It's going to be difficult to address something that you might have not identified, or if you have identified it, you haven't given it a name yet. So what I usually say to people is, let's start with the basic stuff first. Have I eaten? Have I planned my day out? What am I meant to do at work? The answer to this last question in some places is not there. In some workplaces, it's not clear what the person's responsibilities are. And that is one of the biggest contributors to people struggling at work and the development of mental illnesses because of work-induced stress. To give you an example, on Robben Island, when you had the Rivonia trialists and the other people that were arrested there, they had to break rocks and things like that. And these people, day one, go break down this section of rocks. Day two, go break down that section. There was no clear order. And that was done deliberately to disorientate them. Now imagine you go to a workplace, your responsibilities are not clear, your expectations are not clear. Imagine the impact of that on your mental health. Other questions that you can ask yourself, when I knock off, what am I going to be doing that makes me happy? What am I going to do with my time. How did my day go? Did it go well? Did it not go well? Is there anything that I could have done better?
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything that I could have done in a healthier way? It's those small questions. What time am I going to go to bed? What is my sleep like? Do I wake up feeling refreshed? How do I respond to stress? Does a stressful event stay in my mind for hours on end, for days on end? When I'm having a bad day, does that bad day extend to days, weeks? It's going to be small things like that. And then lastly, and I can't emphasize this strongly enough, I would strongly recommend that people start to do what we call our wellness visits to their family doctor, to their clinic. You don't need to go to these people when you're unwell. Go to them to make sure your blood pressure is okay. I call it knowing your numbers. Know your blood pressure, know your cholesterol, know the circumference around your tummy. These things might seem insignificant, but we do know that if they are not attended to, they can have an adverse impact on your health and your mental health by extension. So, small things.
Now that we know all of this, we want to create a wholesome work environment. You know, one of the things that I heard from Coach Laurie is that sometimes if we repetitively do the incorrect thing at work, it sometimes becomes culture. As we end this amazing conversation, which I really don't want to stop, Laurie, give me a send-off. You know, how can we create a wholesome, healthier work environment so that the people that are there don't just rock up because we want to be paid, but because we really want to be there and we enjoy being there?
You know, it really does start with yourself. Because it's how are you showing up? If you are showing up empty, if you are showing up frustrated, so the way that I like to get to an example I always like to give is you get those diffusers, you know, that you put in lavender and vanilla and then the room smells amazing. If you imagine that you are the diffuser of your home, you are the diffuser of your team in that office, and whatever you're putting into there is permeating out. And so if you're putting in stress and resentment and frustration and anxiety, it stinks. But if you are putting yourself in the calendar and you are asking yourself those amazing questions and you're putting in gratitude and contentment and joy, it's not to say that we're not going to have challenges and stresses, but the way that we're showing up to it and the way that we're enabling other people makes it so much easier to get through. So I think to have that amazing workplace is what is the energy we bringing to it? Because when we can bring a great energy to the team, then that's going to, you know, even if there's something challenging, then we can get it done together. And we're part of something bigger. So for me, it really does start with self.
I think from my side, I'll use an example again of something that many people have experienced. Let's use the sniffles or the flu. It is only when your nostrils are blocked, you can't breathe, and you always have to have a tissue with you. It's when the act of swallowing a sip of water feels like there's an explosion going on at the back there. That's the moment you value the ability of being able to breathe without thinking about it and to swallow without thinking about it. The same principle applies to mental health. Take care of your brain, take care of your mental health so that you don't get to the point where you're now struggling with attention or memory or problem solving or prioritizing. Because when you get there, that's when you realize how important doing these things without thinking about it is, right? So take care of your mental health. Seeing a psychiatrist, seeing a psychologist, seeing a life coach, seeing your family doctor is not a sign of weakness. The opposite is true, actually. It's actually a sign of strength to attend to something that impacts your health, that impacts your ability to work, that it impacts your ability to take care of your family and your community. So help is available. Please reach out and get it.
Dr. Masibula, thank you.
Thank you.
Laurie Milner,
thank you.
Both of you are something else. My name's Ilana. And this is Mind at Work.